listening to Tin Pod Radio. I'm Adam P. Nave, co-writer of The Once and Future Queen.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a panic. I just turned my computer on just casually, never had any problems with it, and it was all black screen.
That's always how it goes. They know when you have something important, it's like, deep doop, don't want to work anymore, bye.
Yeah, my first thought was, I haven't backed up in a while either. How are you doing today?
Good. We got nice weather up in Sacramento, so yay. It's like, we've been running, our old lady cat kept my husband and I up all night long. It's like every 2 hours, meow, meow, I'm bored. Like, oh, please let us sleep, baby, please.
So to start out, do you want to give a little bit of an introduction and a background?
Sure. My name's Lee Dragoon, and I'm a web programmer for my day job. And then I do comics, illustrations, and writing, and prose in my spare time.
In your spare time?
So it's basically my second job.
So, I think the first time I ever talked to you online was actually on LiveJournal a while back.
Yeah, probably. I think you're right.
I don't know anybody that's still on LiveJournal since, like, I guess somebody in Russia bought it and stuff.
Yeah, that was about when I bailed. I did the hard delete on my account and just trashed it. Like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah, and the first time, I think what you were working on in that time was when you were doing for, wasn't it Girl Ematic by the Wayside that you were doing?
Yes. That was how I started out. I'd sort of stumbled across Raina Telgemeier's Smile comic, which she'd been doing on Girl-O-Matic. And I had emailed her to ask her if there was some kind of, what the procedure would be to submitting my stuff. And she... I mean, this was a while ago. I think she told me there was an open call coming up. So I basically got a, submission packet together and waited for the open call. And then when they did open it, I submitted my stuff. And Lisa Jonte, who is the editor at the time, accepted it and let me start posting on there.
So is By the Wayside available anywhere right now?
It's pretty much on hiatus. I want to get back to it someday. But when I was working on it, I kind of had two things working against me where... I'm not one of those writers who has an innate sense of story structure. Some people are just really good at it. They just have kind of a gut instinct on how to do it right. And I am not one of those people. So I had to pretty much put myself through some workshops and stuff to get my brain wrapped around story structure. So the By the Wayside, when I was working on it, doesn't have a good story structure. It's kind of a mess. And then I also had really bad unmedicated OCD at the time, so I was drawing like the same page 12 times in a row. So I kind of got burned out on that and needed to take a break for a while. But I would like to, I have some stuff I've been, messing around with for it. I'd like to get back to it someday, but it's that kind of thing where the paying work always ends up taking priority over the non-paying work.
Yeah. It's interesting, a lot of the people whose work I discovered during that time, such as, like you mentioned, Renee Telemunger, who I've met several times at ALA conventions, and very nice person.
Yeah.
A lot of people come out of around that time, not only Girl-O-Matic, but other works. It's interesting if you track back the history of people working on stuff today back to around that time.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a sweet spot in a lot of web stuff where there were web comics, but there weren't a ton of outlets for them yet. And I think Girl-O-Matic was, I think it was kind of in the right place at the right time to sort of curate a lot of that stuff. And I know there have been problems with different companies trying to figure out a way to monetize their web comics. And I'm not sure if, what was that imprint that, was it Marvel was trying to do, like Zuda or something like that?
Yeah, I remember that.
I think it was about 10 years ago, and I'm not sure what happened with that. But yeah, it is funny, one of my relatives is friends with a comic artist, and he kept telling me, you guys have to meet each other, blah, blah, blah. And I finally figured out I already know this guy, I just didn't know his real name. I've known his internet handle for 10 years. But I think he was on Girl-O-Matic too back in the day.
Yeah.
It is funny, it's like every, you're right, I mean, you can trace back quite a bit.
Yeah, with Renee Telemunger and... another artist I liked around that time was, I think her name, Rachel, I forgot her name.
Do you remember what comic she was doing? There was a bunch of Rachels that were doing web comics at the time.
Was it Amber's or, I can't remember now, sorry. But there was a lot of people doing some work, like you said, and it was kind of a sweet spot because, like, there wasn't this glut of work, so your work could actually reach a lot of people, like, in a lot of ways. You talked about having some issues with writing structure. Does adapting other people's work, like you've done for, like, graphic novels and stuff, help in the learning process to do stuff like that?
I think for me, it helped a lot. Like, one of the big things that really helped me big time was I attended this workshop called CSSF that's in Kansas, and it's taught by Kij Johnson, and she devotes a lot of the novel workshop to structure. But I think adapting, it was like she gave us a lot of tools at the workshop, but then when I was able to do a lot of, especially that it was YA adaptations, a lot of YA authors are really, really excellent story structure people. They have it down pat. And especially like the Vampire Academy books and the Legend books that Marie Lu wrote, being able, because I sort of had to pull them apart to create, you know, to adapt them over to comic scripts. And it really helped me see how they were putting this stuff together and how they were implementing a lot of the stuff that Kij had talked about. Like, I think for me, it was a huge, huge help. It really helped me get it more. And I mean, I think it was a combination of those two things, like having some tricks that you can do, but then being able to see it in action too.
Yeah. How does it, like, when you talk about adapting work such as you did on, like, you did the Fairy Path books and Vampire Academy, how does that differ from creating your own work?
I guess it depends. Like, the Fairy Path ones were really structured in that I didn't create the... they weren't straight adaptations of the... they weren't straight adaptations of the novels. They were original stories that Frewin Jones had produced for that universe, which were intended to be adapted into the scripts. So I would get a complete story outline, and then I would have to write all the dialogue and actually expand that story outline out into an actual... into a script. The Marie Lu books and the Vampire Academy books were straight, like, here is the novel. You need to adapt it to a graphic novel script that is this precise amount of pages and everything. And I mean, they were interesting challenges, but it doesn't really kind of scratch the same itch that writing your own stuff does. And I tried, especially with the Vampire Academy stuff, I tried very hard. Like, if, you know, I did a couple of signings for the graphic novels, and I did try to stress that all I did was adapt her work, it, you know, that she's the one who came up with all these characters. It's her story. I just tried to be, to create a truth, you know, an adaptation of it that was faithful to the original material.
Is there any wiggle room for you creating new stuff for them when you do that?
Not really. The companies that okay the adaptations know that the people who are most likely to buy them are people who are fans of the source material, and they want them to be very, very faithful to them.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Is I don't mean to say drawbacks in a bad way, but
oh no, I mean, it's just, it's a job, you know.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, I feel like I learned a lot from taking those, just the way I had to kind of pull the books apart to figure out, especially a couple of the later Legend books, there was a lot of stuff where I just couldn't leave it in. You know, you're taking a 360 page prose novel and you're trying to condense it down into a 160 page graphic novel script. You got to get rid of something. So pulling the whole thing apart makes it easier to see, okay, well, this character was really cool and it was a nice thing in the book, but I don't really need it in the graphic novel. It doesn't really add to the plot, you know.
Is there back and forth when it comes to that, where you leave something out and they say put it in, or vice versa?
Yeah, but usually I didn't have any kind of bad experiences working. Usually what happens is I would do an outline where I have this program that I really love named called Super Note Card that I use for laying out story synopses and outlines and things. And I would lay out the whole thing in there and then export it and send the outline with how I was planning on breaking it down back to the editor. And then they send it to the actual author. So the author would sign off on everything. And I never had any problems working with either Rochelle Mead or Marie Lu. They were great. You know, they understood why certain things had to come out. Mostly the notes I would get back were like, can you just clarify this one little thing? And that's more than fair. I don't know if you read any of the Vampire Academy stuff. Rochelle Mead's universe is really complicated. You know, I tried really hard to be clear with how she set everything up.
With your own prose work, did you learn from adapting someone else's prose to writing your own?
No, I don't think so, but it's hard to say because I'm older than dirt, so fan fiction wasn't really a, and I grew up in the middle of nowhere, so fanfic wasn't really a thing. But I sure wrote a lot of really crappy stories that were very clearly based on, like, Dragon Riders of Pern books, which I was obsessed with when I was 9 years old, and I think I broke away from that at some point, and I tried really hard at, I think, kind of a young age to write my own original content, which is not to say, I'm sure if you look back, you can see it was probably pretty heavily influenced by whatever I was reading at the time, you know.
What's the most prose you've written yourself?
I have, like, my first horrible novel that I wrote when I was a teenager that I think probably came out to be, like, 600 pages, and it's horrible. I mean, I'm not being facetious, it's just awful. A friend and I swapped our first horrible teen books, and she started reading it, she gets back to me on GChat, and she's like, Lee, they're still eating dinner, and I'm on page 50, how much longer does this go? And I'm like, oh, it goes for a while, don't you worry. They gotta eat dinner for a long time. So I think the first book that I wrote that I actually have a complete manuscript that I'm actually proud of is one that I'm busy. I think it came out about like 250, 300 pages. And I'm busy working on the synopsis for that so I can start whoring it out to editor or to try to get an agent for it. So we'll see. I mean, I'd probably be further along with that, but the Little Witches project is what sold, and that's been a lot of work. Like that, because I wrote that and I'm doing all the art, and I originally pitched it as a black and white book, but they want it to be color, so now I'm also coloring the whole thing too.
Oh, did that come late in the process, when they decided to want it color?
No, in all fairness, they were upfront about that right away. It was just that the process to get it pushed through at Oni took a little while, because I had known one of the editors at Oni from working on a Sam Keith project a few years earlier that kind of never really came together. And I sent her a few pitches, and she really liked the Little Women one. So eventually, she was having some really bad health problems. I think she had MS and had to retire from Oni. So her projects were handed off to a new editor. So basically what ended up happening was I had to resubmit the whole project and then go through the whole submission process all over again and then get it approved again. And at that point, that editor thought it would be good to do it as a color book. So, I mean, that was fine. I'd planned it to be black and white because that was what I'd kind of worked with up to that point for the most part. And I thought it would be more manageable. And I do have to give a shout out for Clip Studio Paint, because that program is the only reason this thing is getting done in a realistic time frame. That program saved my butt big time. I fought doing digital comics for a really long time for no good reason, and I was totally wrong.
That's like, I've seen your artwork for years and stuff. Did you always do your coloring digital, or was it not?
My coloring was usually digital.
Okay.
I usually did all the pencils and inks traditional, and then my husband, who is the best person in the whole world, would scan them in for me and do the line separations. And there was a couple of projects I did freelance that he actually helped lay in the flats for me. Like, I got super lucky in the husband department. He's pretty awesome. But I started doing, like, part of the reason I stopped doing By the Wayside too was the amount of work got really punishing, because I'd sit there and do all the pencils and go through my whole, like, I gotta draw it, it's not perfect yet, 12 times is the charm, yay! And then I'd ink it and scan it in, you know, and thank God my husband would help me. And I'd sit there and do all the, you know, either the colors if it was a color page or the tones for the black and white ones. And at that point, I was pretty ready for that page to be done. But then I'd also have to go in and do the word balloons and the text. And Photoshop and word balloons, they're horrible. It took so long. I'd have to draw the tails by hand. You know, it just took forever. It just felt so punishing. I got really burned out on it. And that was another reason that once I finally stopped fighting doing all the digital stuff, I realized how much, because like I said, it used to be called Manga Studio, and they changed the name to Clip Studio Paint like this year, and I avoided it for a really long time because I would see it at art stores, and I saw it mostly when that manga craze was going really big, when Tokyo Pop was a really big deal, and I assumed wrongly that it was a program that someone had just slapped together to take advantage of the manga craze for teenagers or something. And I eventually figured out it was actually professional quality Japanese comic creation software and got on board with it. And it made it so much easier to do all this stuff. So I pretty much, you know, I started out kind of slow where I would still do the pencils and the inks in the real world and then scan them in. And then I started just doing the pencils in the real world and doing the inking in Manga Studio. And then I kind of, when I got this project approved, I was like, I have to remove as many steps as possible. I have to streamline this as much as possible, so I just drew the whole thing straight in Manga Studio from the get-go.
Are you somebody that works on multiple projects at once, or do you focus on one thing at a time?
I work on multiple projects at the same time, and I have some friends who think I take on a little too much, and I think they're ready to murder me because they're sick of listening to me whine. When I went a little overboard a couple years ago, and I had 3 or 4 projects going at the same time, and that was a little too much on top of the day job. I was wrong. That was too much. So I try really hard to keep it down to a dull roar now, but I try very, very hard to stay organized. And I mean, like I'm saying, it is funny because I fought against, there was no logical reason for it. I just convinced myself that doing digital stuff was cheating for a really long time. And I was wrong. And now I try to use stuff to take as much of the workload off me as possible so I can actually create things. Like, have you ever heard of Scrivener?
The writing program?
Yeah. I hadn't heard of it. And one of my friends, when I went to the workshop one year, she's a big proponent of it because she works on multiple projects. And I was like, I don't understand. What do you need novel writing software for? I've got Word. That's awesome. And she showed me Scrivener, and I was like, okay, I'm wrong, you're right, I'm sorry, Barbara. And I went home and bought it. I mean, I think if you're doing one project at a time, you can make do with WordPerfect or Word. And when you start getting multiple ones going at the same time, you have to have something to help you.
Yeah, I got friends that want me to use it too, and I'm probably getting ready to start using it, because for years I wasn't organized, and I kind of stupidly fought against it.
So I don't know why we do this to ourselves, but yeah. I know it's not just me. It's like, you have to drag us into it kicking and screaming, and then you get us there and we're like, we were wrong.
Yeah, I convinced myself for some reason for years that outlining or anything like that was cheating, that you should just write stuff, and it's like, no.
Once I figured out how much stress it was taking off me to outline, I got really sold on it, because I used to, you know, if you're outlining, you're not really being creative. It's not the same thing. You have to, like, suck at the teat of the muse of writing directly. And I was like, no, I was wrong. Outlining saves me so much effort. Like, the novel project I just finished was one I ran through the workshop the first year I went, where I actually started learning story structure. And I must have pulled that outline apart and put it back together again 10 times. I'm not exaggerating. I think that's how many times I pulled it apart and put it back together again in Super Note Card. And if I hadn't done all that fussing in the outline, I would have thrown out hundreds of pages. It boggled, you know, I literally would have thrown out hundreds and hundreds of pages. I changed stuff so much. The ending, because I, you know, while I was working on that project, I was actually learning how to story structure. So I must have redone the ending 5-6 times just there to try to get it right.
Yeah, right? I'm the type of writer where I always wanted to do complicated stories, but then I wouldn't organize or try to do structure to it, and I'd wonder why things turned out like a mess, you know?
Yeah, me too. You know, and I don't think it helped when I was growing up. I was reading all these authors who make it look so easy. Like, I loved Dragonlance when I was a teenager. Oh my god, I spent so much time and effort. I loved Raceland. Like, oh my god, he just needs the right woman. You know, sure, he had Crisania and she was perfect and he treated her like shit, but he just needs the right lady. And the Tracy Hicks and Margaret Weiss just make it look so easy. Yeah, they make it look so easy. They have all these characters, they weave them all together, but they probably have a much better understanding of story structure than I do.
Yeah, I think especially young artists and writers, they tend to think that the people they admire just create stuff from scratch and there's no planning that goes into it or not, which isn't true, obviously.
I know, and I think I don't think it's as much now. Like, I think people are really honest now about their creative processes, but I think there was kind of a lot of, you know, hand waving before. And maybe it's just that it's easier to read how, you know, maybe with blogs and things, it's just easier to find out how people are actually creating their work now than it was when we were kids, because all we were getting, I mean, I'm over 40. I did not have the internet growing up. We had a computer. You know, we had like a Tandy 1000, and I would write all my horrible stories on that. But we didn't have an internet connection. I didn't get the internet until after I graduated college. And then it was very limited. So, you know, we're getting these end products with these books that are inspiring us so much. And I'm sure it seemed like magic. Like, oh, they must just put it together. You do start to finish and you work in order and then you have a book, right? That's how it works. It just works.
Well, until around the time when I seen your work online, I never knew, because I never seen like really art books. I never knew people the way they drew just characters to start with, you know, the basic shapes and stuff. Like, I never saw that before, because I remember looking at it and it's like, well, that doesn't look like, and then to see the process of what it turns into, I'm like, hey, that takes a lot of work to do that.
Yeah, and I mean, and then every writer, you know, and every artist, they're slightly different too, because, you know, everyone's process is a little different. That's one thing I try really hard not, because I'm friends with a lot of people who are artists at different ages and things, or, you know, they're just trying to learn how to paint now. And I try really hard to give them techniques and stuff without telling them there's only one way to do stuff, because there isn't. There's so many different ways of getting the same thing done. You just have to find what works for you, you know. Stuff that works for me might not work for someone else at all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've told people, like, they ask me, like, doing anything, and I'm like, they're like, how do you do this? And I'm like, well, my process actually starts with I'm gonna mess up a lot to learn, and then I'll use that as my structure for doing it. But that's stupid for other people to do, but I have to do it a little bit. It's like learning computer stuff. I tend to like just fool around with it until I learn how to do it.
Yeah, that's the same with me. It's like I pretty much expect to hit the ground running with, if I have to learn a new program or something, I get very frustrated if I have to actually go look at the documentation. Like, not the documentation, I'm not a rube, just it should just be able to figure it out.
I have artist friends who are going digital now, and they know I use Photoshop and GIMP and other programs, and they're like, well, how do you do this? And I'm like, I don't know. I just know how I do it. The program probably has an easier way of doing it.
Yeah, like, and again, especially with Photoshop, that you can get the exact same effect like four different ways. My husband and I were working on a project together once, and I realized we each had a completely different way to arrive at the same result in Photoshop. It worked just as well. It took, you know, pretty much the same ass steps. It was just we each had a completely different process.
Earlier today, I looked over your website, and I was looking at how, and I didn't know this, that you had worked on Adventure Time stuff.
Yes. The Adventure Time books are prose novels that are set in the Adventure Time universe, so I basically got paid to write official fanfic. Yay!
How was it getting into that universe, which is really popular?
It helped that my husband is a really big fan of the show, so he had downloaded the whole series pretty much. So I don't know, when it's stuff like that, it's like I said, I try to be really, because I know a lot of the fans are younger, and I know how important stuff like that is when you're that age. You know what I mean? Like, how seriously you take it. So I try really hard to make sure I'm accurately representing the characters' voices. And we had some, like, the Adventure Time books, luckily, one of the other people they hired to do one is a friend of mine, so we were kind of able to sort of emotionally support each other, because it had a really, really tight deadline. And we had some wiggle room with them, because they're sort of set in alternate universe versions of Adventure Time. So it's Adventure Time characters, but it's alternate versions of those characters. So, like I said, you know, I did try to be accurate to the way the characters' voices sound, but I basically just sit down and watch like a billion episodes of the show over and over and over and over and over again. And then I had the horrible earworm closing and opening song stuck in my head for a couple of months. And the only one worse than that was the Ever After High, because Ever After High, have you ever seen it?
No, I don't think I have.
I was very skeptical about it when they pitched that project. Like, oh, you want to work on this? I'm like, it's a doll project. And then I actually started reading about it. It is really cute. It's this whole idea that there's all of these characters who are the children of the fairy tale heroes and heroines that we've grown up reading about, and they all attend this high school where it's just sort of taken for granted that if your mother is Cinderella, you are going to grow up, you're going to do all the exact same Cinderella things and sort of reinvigorate that story by recreating it for your generation, but you have to hit those same points. So then the school splits into two factions where there's the kids who want to follow their destinies and the kids who want to write their own stories. It's a really cute show. It's really well written. I kind of went in wanting to hate it and ended up loving it. It's, you can tell a lot of love went into the animation. It's really beautiful. But oh my god, the opening song is the biggest earworm of all time. It's so earwormy. I had that thing stuck in my head for months. And then the characters speak in this kind of fairy tale lingo. So I had to watch it a lot. And each episode's like 15 minutes, like 7 to 10 minutes long, I think. So I'd hear the intro song over and over and over again every 7 to 10 minutes. So I had a lot of fun on that. But oh my god. That song, that horrible earwormy song, it's so catchy.
Is that a Disney thing?
It's actually a Mattel toy line. And I really liked the animation because I could tell they must have been doing some kind of flash animation because the characters are really complicated and the art for it, you can tell they wanted to try to be as faithful to the way the dolls look as possible. And I ended up tracking down the studio because I was just curious. I was like, you know, this art, you can tell a lot of love is going into this show. The backgrounds are really well painted, the animation's really good, and it was a French-Canadian studio using this animation package that I think is called Harmony. I hadn't heard of it before. It looked pretty cool. They had some, they're sort of doing that thing that a lot of the art packages are doing now where they'll have different levels of licenses so people who aren't pros can get used to using it to build their portfolios. But I haven't had a chance to play with it at all.
Back to when you did the Adventure Time, did you pitch ideas to them or did they bring story ideas to you?
Basically, the way that worked was they had commissioned the cover art for the books. And they were like, here's the cover art. You can write whatever you want as long as it matches the cover art. So I was like, okay, here, it's Fiona, and she's on a pirate, and here's the title. You know, she's on a pirate ship, and here's the title. So you can write whatever you want, as long as it sounds like it fits within the Adventure Time universe. You know, they wanted that kind of dream logic that Adventure Time has. But I actually had a lot of freedom with the actual plots, which was fun.
I've never heard of that way of working. Somebody giving you a piece of artwork.
No, neither had I. They're like, here's the cover. Just make sure it, you know, matches the cover. And in all fairness, the covers are really cute. They hired a really good artist to do them.
My girlfriend's a huge fan of Adventure Time, so she'll be happy I talked to somebody that worked on anything Adventure Time related. The thing I, showing my age a little bit, get excited about is seeing that you worked on Fraggle Rock stuff.
Yeah, that was really fun because I'd met this editor named Tim Beadle through Tokyopop, and he was the one who picked me to, like, I'd run into him at a convention, and he saw some of the By the Wayside stuff, and he liked the way that I wrote. So we'd sort of gone back and forth trying to work on different Tokyopop projects, and they kept getting canceled, because I think for a little while, Tokyopop wanted to do a line of light novels. Have you heard of those before? They're more common in Japan. I don't think they really took off here. It's kind of like a YA novel, but it's illustrated.
No, and they call them. I don't think I've heard of them.
Yeah, they call them light novels. They seem like they have, I like the anime Kino's Journey, and I think that started out as a series of light novels. So Tokyopop wanted to do their own series of these. So I kept pitching ideas, and they would get okayed, and then Tokyopop would cancel the line. So he put me on the Fairy Path stuff, and then eventually he was let go of Tokyopop when they downsized a bunch of their editors. And he ended up working for IDW, and the Fraggle Rock stuff came up, so he thought that I would be a good fit for that project and recommended me.
That's an interesting path.
That was a lot of fun, but that was another one where it's like, gotta watch the same episode 50 times in a row because the characters talk. You know, I love Fraggle Rock. I loved it so much when I was a kid, and I wanted really bad to be faithful to the way the characters talk and that it felt like a Fraggle Rock story, not just a story where someone came in and wrote some stuff. And it is supposed to be Fraggle Rock, but nobody sounds right.
And that's another catchy opening song too.
Yep, had that one in my head for like 6 weeks. Like, oh my god, just shut up, Brain, shut up.
So you worked also on the Woman Anthology book.
Yeah, the way they set the Mariah Huener was the editor for those, and the way they wanted to set them up was they wanted to maximize the number of creators in each book, so she would pair the writers up with artists. So, yeah, I provided the art for, I think it was a 6 or 7 page story that someone else wrote. That was a lot of fun. That was because I hadn't done comics for a couple of years at that point, and that was kind of how I got back into it. And I was so rusty. It must have taken me 12 hours to do each page just because I forgot how to do things right. I'm really proud with how it turned out, but it was kind of a punishing workload.
Had you did a lot of art with other people writing before that?
No, I would love to collaborate on stuff. It's really hard to find someone that you can work with. Like I said, I tried to work on a few Sam Keith projects and they just fell through, which, you know, it was kind of nobody's fault. It's just the way it happened. And it's kind of a thing in comics where you'll almost always have more writers who need an artist than an artist who needs a writer, because a lot of artists pull double duty. So I guess I kind of always figured at the end of the day, if I had to, I could draw it myself. I mostly, just because of time limitations, at this point, unless it's a project I'm really, really passionate about, I try to just do the writing as opposed to the writing and the art, just because it's such a huge amount of work. But I am working with this Greek artist I met through Sam Keith named Vasilis, and we're working on a pitch for a series that I would write, and then he would do the art, and I really love his art.
So with your current project you're working on, that would be the Little Witches, right?
Yeah. We went back and forth on the title some. I think right now it's going to be Little Witches, Magic, and Concord.
Oh. So with that project right there, how did that come about in the beginning?
I could feed you a really good line of BS, but it was totally crass commercialism, because I was lying in bed one night and I'm like, people really like witches and people really like Little Women. I wonder what would happen if I put the two together. And Little Women is one of my all-time favorite books. It's one of those books I reread every year. So once I started working on it, I was having a lot of fun, and I tried to incorporate a lot of the stuff that the real life people had happen to them or whatever. It's been a lot of fun. I'm really proud of that project. I hope people like it.
Did you reread the original books before you did it?
Oh yeah, I mean, I reread those every year. And it's like I cry when, it's never right when Beth dies that I start crying. It's always when Joe is waking up thinking she's hearing Beth calling out for her in the night, and Beth dies. But the family was really fascinating. Louise May Alcott's mother was one of the first paid, someone who goes and helps people who are poor. I'm spacing on the word. But her family, they were really interesting. Her mom was very active, and her dad was kind of this weird, veiled philosopher type, but they were friends with Thoreau and Emerson and they all kind of knew each other. They're really interesting people.
What's it like working with Omnipress on this book?
Oh, I'm sorry. Say again. You cut out a little.
Oh, sorry. What's it like working with the publisher on this book?
I've had absolutely no complaints with Omnipress. I really like my editor. I mean, they've been really supportive. I just try really hard to give accurate timelines and then meet them. I've had absolutely no complaints.
You seem like you worked with a wide variety of publishers from your time.
Yeah, it's I guess I didn't realize before I started doing some of this stuff how wide some of these publishing houses branch out. It didn't occur to me that, I mean, I guess it was kind of naive, but it didn't occur to me how much stuff that Penguin had going and Random House, and, you know, it was sort of an eye-opener that they all kind of are interconnected with all these, animated television shows and toy lines and things like that.
Yeah, so right now you're mainly focused on doing the Little Witches book. Do you have any future projects after it lined up, or is that your main focus right now?
That's been my main focus right now, but I think writers and artists were all kind of hustlers. So, yeah, we're always going to have 10 projects in the hopper. It just depends which one you can convince someone to give you money for.
That's true. Would you rather do more art or writing, or is it just whatever comes your way?
I think it depends on the project, because there's some stories that I come up with where they just sort of feel like a prose project, and then there's some where I envisioned them as a comic from the get-go. And it's funny, because it's kind of like once I have that in my head, I don't really switch them over. It's sort of always in that space in my mind. But I would like to, you know, when I get some time, I've got a couple short comic stories that I would really like to do, because they're like 10 to 15 pages, and I think the art would be really, really fun.
Yeah, I know that that's a little bit like that with me. If I get an idea for something, it's kind of just stuck. That's the only way it has to be and stuff a little
bit. Yeah, and then I need to get off my, like, one of my friends and I, we said that this year our New Year's resolution was to come up with more realistic goals, because we usually overload ourselves pretty badly and then stress out when we are not robots and we can't do all the things all at once. So I would like to do more short stories and get better at sending them out, because I know it's all my own fault. I'm kind of at this point where I send stuff out and get good rejection letters and then throw a fit and don't send anything out for a while. And I just need to rip that Band-Aid off and just send them out. And then it's, okay, it got rejected. Send it somewhere else.
I understand that, though, too. I've sent stuff out to companies like comic publishers, and I get back something with something actually written to me, and I'm like, oh, I'm rejected, you know, and friends will be like, no, they actually wrote something to you. That's something.
I know, and logically, you know it's good. You know logically it's good when you get a personalized rejection letter, but it still hurts because they didn't like your brain baby.
Yeah.
It's like, here's my brain baby. It's so pretty. Oh, you didn't reject it. You didn't like it. It's still hard when they hate your brain baby.
I had a friend who's an editor once tell me, she's like, if an editor sends you something back and it's written "this sucks" on it, that means it's something that they feel something about.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I got really, really lucky when I met Sam Keith, because he is one of the genuinely nicest people I have ever met. And he was telling me when, I think he was 17 or 18 or something, he had a whole bunch of stuff in his portfolio, and he went to a comic convention and showed his stuff to, I think, maybe a Marvel editor or something. They told him he sucked and he had no future in comics. They said he was just terrible. And I don't know, I think it's a weird balance to try to maintain, because I've met people where their stuff really is terrible, and it's like, you maybe should kind of let this dream go. But then I've read stuff that got published where I'm like, this is just awful, but it made all the money, so what do I know, you know? I think it's that balancing act of, you just have to get your head down and throw stuff out there and see what happens, and try to be open to feedback, and, you know, try to cultivate relationships with people whose work you really respect, so you're getting good quality critiques.
Yeah, I shot myself in the foot for years, because I spent like probably close to 8 years not writing, because I'd gotten like, oh, I'm getting rejected every time for stuff and stuff like that. So I was almost like, didn't do it for a long time.
Well, it wears you down. It is kind of exhausting. I think some people just kind of, it doesn't bother them as much, or they can put it in a mental closet a little more easily. Some people, I think it just kind of sticks in our heads.
Yeah, and then
it's hard to get it out.
And then after a little while, I learned that, like, it's a stupid thing that you hear as a cliche, but it's true, that the more you do it, the better you get at it. And, like, I just started writing tons and start gradually noticing, which we don't a lot of times, notice the getting better as you go stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's easy to overlook when you're doing a lot of stuff, too. I think it is kind of important to take a moment and go back 5 or 6 years and see what you did that long ago, and you can see improvement a lot of the time, and it really is a boost.
I think I just remembered the artist I was thinking of earlier. Rachel Neighbors, I think is her name.
Yeah, she was doing a webcomic. Oh, she was actually one of the only webcomic artists that I knew who was actually making a living wage off of her webcomic, but I can't remember the name of the company that was publishing her. I think it was like a subsidiary of Oh, I can't remember. It was so long ago.
But I remember, like, she was one of those people around that time that I seen her work online.
Yeah, she had a really big fan base. Like, her writing, you know, her stuff really resonated with her target audience. It's a lot of young 20-somethings and older teens. She was really good at writing for them.
looking back at that time, which we talked about LiveJournal and stuff like that, that was one of the few platforms you had for your work. Like, you could just post it on a website, and hopefully you could have somebody that would promote it more or something like that on a bigger thing. Are you, because I find myself a little bit like this, envious today of looking at people who are just starting out and saying, you got all these platforms for your work now.
I guess I haven't thought about it much just because I haven't looked at, like, it sort of looked like a lot of the comic stuff migrated over to Tumblr, and I've seen a lot on there, and I use Pinterest a lot. I know people like making fun of Pinterest, but I have found that it's really useful for organizing visual references for different projects. I must have like 6 or 7 different boards that are just for the Little Women project that are, you know, clothing references and room references and houses and things. And I have noticed a lot of people, which I think is really clever, I've noticed a lot of people are starting to post webcomics onto Pinterest. And I mean, you remember back in the day, there was, what was the name of that company that a lot of people were posting their comic, their webcomics on back in the day? Was it just webcomics.net or something?
I think it was, actually.
Yeah, because I knew a bunch of people through there. And remember, they had that, they all sort of had that same layout where they had the back and forward button and everyone would sort of format their pages the same.
Yeah.
The comics that I've seen people posting on Pinterest are designed where instead of being broken into pages, they just make one long comic. And I was like, that's really clever because most people do scroll down now. I thought that was really smart. So the ones that I've been seeing float through a lot are kind of more like one-offs. You know, it's not a big, long, continuing story. They're little self-contained vignette, slice-of-life type things that specific people are doing.
I mean, with digital comics going, and he was saying this back then, but I remember Scott McCloud back when, like, you were first doing your work and stuff was saying, it's not going to take off until people do more than just post an image online. Like, you gotta adapt to the technology and stuff. And I don't think people, maybe they're just now starting to do it a little bit, but I don't think they've fully done it yet.
I think Comixology looks really promising. I was able to find, there's a Russian artist whose stuff I really like, and I was able to track her comic down on Comixology, and you know, I'm not sure I would have been able to find it otherwise, but I think what might really push digital comics is just the proliferation of iPads. It's like we finally have a really good format to view this stuff in. Because I remember when they were very first starting to put out some digital comics, I have a really old Kindle. I have one of the, I think they call it the Kindle keyboard now, where it has a little keyboard on it still. Mm-hmm. And yeah, thing's awesome, still works. I plugged it in the other day. And I remember there were a couple comics I got for it, and it was very limited. You know, it's black and white. The formatting was really weird. The programming's not so great. You can pretty much just do a direct, like exactly what it looks like on the shelf is what it looks like on an iPad now, or, you know, I'm assuming in a Kindle Fire. I've never used one, but I think it's good times for digital comics and digital, you know, self-published novels. Because I've heard people, they said the same thing about webcomics back in the day, where they're like, oh, all these people self-publishing, it's going to be terrible because they're going to flood the market with crap. And they said the exact same stuff about webcomics, but I think it's true that the cream tends to rise to the top and, you know, good work will attract attention. And there's a couple of authors I found recently who, you know, self-publish through Amazon, and their work is really good. You know, it's definitely professional quality. I don't think self-publishing is for everybody. I know people where they really seem to need an editor, but I have a couple friends who do it, who are really professional. Like my friend Barbara Webb, she's been self-publishing and she takes it really seriously. You know, she's a really good writer to begin with. She writes really good clean prose just to start, but she always gets a copy editor. She gets the covers professionally designed and laid out. Her stuff's really good. I'm kind of excited to see what kind of options are out there.
Yeah, that's what I tell people, because I also hire an editor for my self-published work. And I tell them, if you can afford it, do it. It'll make a thousand. It's you might think you don't need one. Everybody needs one.
Everybody. Yeah. It's just because we're really bad at copy editing our own work, because our brain knows what it expects to see. So it's a lot easier to catch typos and things in someone else's work than it is in your own.
Yeah. And like my next book I'm going to be putting out is actually like a time travel book. So not only has the last couple years of learning how to organize going to be helpful, having an editor for something like that is going to be helpful too.
Oh man, I can imagine.
One of the things, like, I know this is about some of your photography I've seen lately.
I do it for funsies. Like, I'm not a real photographer. I just have my little Nexus. I think it's a Nexus 5. I just use the little camera phone. But I got on Instagram because my niece is on Instagram, and I wanted to be able to see what she's up to. And I'm like, well, nobody can possibly get offended by wildflower and kitty pictures, so that is all I shall post.
Is that like a fun little outlet thing for you to do that you don't stress yourself out about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky. I live in Sacramento, and the climate up here sort of means that something is always in season. And my dad and I are kind of nature nerds, so a lot of times I'll take a picture of a flower and then try to figure out what it was once I get home. You know, I'll start going through field guides or whatever.
Cool.
But I have been trying very hard to have actual hobbies, not hobbies that turn into jobs, because I have a problem with that. So I've been playing a little with Sculpey, and I've been picking up, like, I'll go to, you know, hardware stores with nurseries and pick up crappy plants from the, we put the dying plant here for 75% off rack, sort of try to nurse them back to health.
I tried to do it. A friend of mine, Jenny Gilgood, who's a artist too, she was saying, find something creative. It's a hobby, but not like if you want to really do as like a professional thing. So I started doing a stop motion thing. So,
oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah. Though I had to stop myself one day because I was like, wonder what it would be to do a full movie like that. And I was like, no.
Yep, see, there, that's how you get in trouble.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess, like, my sister and I, we grew up pretty poor. Like, we grew up in upstate New York, about 15 minutes away from the Canadian border, in a log cabin that my dad built from scratch. And we never felt poor. Like, my parents were very creative, and, you know, when you're in an area where everyone's poor, you don't really feel like you're going without a lot of things. So we never felt poor, but both my sister and I are pretty obsessed with money, and it's like, we always got to figure out an angle. Like, what if the other shoe drops and I lose my job, or my hands fall off and I can't program anymore? I better have a backup. So it's hard to get a hobby that part of your brain doesn't sit there and try to figure out a way to generate income off of it. It's like, no brain, no, this is a hobby, stop. It's a hobby for fun. Like, what fun? What's that about?
So to let you go here, and thank you again for agreeing to talk to me today.
Oh, no problem.
And sorry if everything was a little disjointed. It was a little bit chaotic when we started. if you want to let people know where they could find you online, if there's somewhere you want to point towards.
Yeah, I just try to keep my website up to date. It's just leedragoon.com. So I try to, whatever I'm working on up there, I do try. I mean, sometimes I'll get a little snowed under and I don't update things on there as much as I should, but I do try to at least make sure if a project's coming out that I have, you know, links to the Amazon page or for the book.
And do you want to promote anything right now, your work or even a charity, if you want to promote it or anything?
Well, for charities, I mean, if anyone wants to donate any money to local animal rescues, I would totally support that. My husband and I have been fosters for Happy Tails. It's a local rescue in Sacramento for about 15 years, and we just kind of had to take a break the last couple years because we had a lot of very elderly cats that were getting sick, and, you know, that kind of took all our attention. And it was really hard because we lost like 4 cats in 4 years. It just sucked.
Yeah, we had 2 cats pass a couple years ago, and we really haven't gotten any since, but we plan to soon.
Well, I would offer you some of mine, but I'm kind of attached. So, like, dang, they're cute.
That's
not
why,
so much when they're trying to throw up on me at 3 in the morning, but the rest of the time, they're pretty cute.
That's why I've thought about doing the fostering thing, but then it's like, you're going to keep them all.
It's actually a little easier if you get a litter of kittens, because, yes, they're cute, but then they hit that age where they are tearing your entire house apart when they're around 3 months old, and you're like, oh my god, they have to go. They have to leave right now. Some friends of ours, a neighborhood cat, had 6 kittens on my back porch, and I caught all of them, and these friends very kindly agreed to foster them for Happy Tails, because we had our hands full with another litter of kittens that had fallen off of our neighbor's roof, and 5 of the kittens looked practically identical. They were little orange tabbies. The whole litter, all 6 kittens were males, and it was really cute until they're about 2 months old, and every time you would try to go into the room they lived in, they would mob you like, oh my god, it's a human. We want attention. And then they got older and were pulling their whole house apart because my friend had fostered before. She had done a lot of fostering of bottle babies and things, but she was kind of concerned to foster because she thought her husband wouldn't be able to give them up. When you have six kittens tearing your whole house apart, they could not wait to get them out the door and into their forever homes.
Have you seen that meme online, which is basically like 20 kittens and it's trying, the person is trying to put them all in line, and it's basically like,
oh man,
this is me trying to organize all my projects during the day is what the memes call.
That sounds about right, because yeah, the biggest litter Gordon and I've ever done at one time was 10. Someone dumped a box of 10 kittens, it must have been two litters they combined, off at the local feed store, and we were the suckers who walked in with the neon sucker sign over our heads 5 minutes later. So we take all, we're like, okay, you know, they're trying to give these kittens away. The people at the feed store were really nice, but they didn't know what to do with kittens so small. So we just came back with carriers, got all 10 of them. And, you know, it's kind of manageable for a little while, but then we would get home from work and they would all be screaming at the top of their lungs till we put their soft food down. So they had a whole bowl of hard food, but that's crap. We want the soft food. And I mean, luckily they were sort of all different weights. So, because typically we get them fixed when they hit 3 pounds. So we were able to get them into the vet to get fixed and out for adoptions in different waves. And that kind of made it manageable. But I will never forget the sound of all that screaming in unison as soon as we would get home from work.
Yeah, makes me think maybe one of these days you'll do a cat book or something.
I do have one comic I did that's on my webpage that is a story that my sister told me about her cat, because her cat loves her husband and just views my sister as this interloping whore that she has to share the husband with.
That's interesting. Like, yeah, I had a friend who her cat loved me, but it hated her.
You know, some cats are just one person cats. We've gotten pretty lucky. The cats that my husband and I have kind of love everybody. But yeah, I've met some where they love one person and that is it. They're done.
Well, again, thank you for joining me today. And I'll put up all information about your website and everything else up so people can find that.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. You